Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, Denny Griffin here, and welcome to Meet the Author. For the next 45 minutes, I'll be hosting the show, and my guest today is Mr. Bill Ferguson. Bill is the author of Laughter on the Rivers of Death, One Sailor's Humorous Experiences in Vietnam. It chronicles humorous events that evoke laughter along Bill Ferguson's route from a cushy job on shore duty in the Boston Navy Yard in 1968 to becoming a brown water sailor. And during the war, Bill spent 7 months as a boat captain on a 31-foot patrol boat operating on Vietnam's Rivers of Death. For the last 5 months of his tour, he was a patrol officer in charge of a two-boat patrol assigned to stop enemy war supplies from getting through. He made over 250 combat patrols and engaged the enemy in excess of 20 times. He was awarded the Bronze Star, Navy Commendation, and Purple Heart. And I believe Bill is on the line with us right now. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Denny.
How are you this morning?
Well, I think I'm okay.
Okay, good. You got up to make the call, right? That's a good sign. Listen, thanks for being on with me this morning.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I feel honored, and I've been in good company.
Thank you. What I'd like to do, Bill, is we're going to be on here for 45 minutes, and first let me say if anybody has a question or comment for Bill or for me, you can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. And if you're listening through my Blog Talk Radio site, you can log into the chat room, Dennis N. Griffin chat room, and text a question or comment, and we'll handle it that way. Bill, would you want to give a little background? Now, you approached your Vietnam book a little different than most. Most Vietnam books are stories, you know, the heavy stuff, the combat and the war piece of it, and you've taken a little different approach looking at some of the humorous things. Could you tell us how you happened to decide to do that or why you decided to take a humorous look as opposed to the more traditional Vietnam War books?
Well, the impetus for my getting started on the book, first of all, came from a news reporter asking me a series of questions about my opinion on the Navy's reinventing the wheel, so to speak, where they're digging up the riverine warfare and applying it to the rivers of Iraq. Very timely and very eventful evolution for the Navy to go back to that riverine warfare. During the course of my discussion with the newspaper reporter, I told him a couple of funny stories, and he said, you know, that's funny. You ought to write a book. And I thought about it for a while, and I said, you know, to myself, I said, I'm retired. I got time on my hands. My wife's telling me I'm spending too much time on the golf course over there at the Chuan Golf and Country Club. So I decided to take some time and put it all on paper. I mean, let's face it. There are any number of war books out there, when I say war books, books about the war that explain in significant detail the battles that were fought. During those battles, funny things happened. I mean, it may seem incongruous to those that haven't been there, but there's something funny about not knowing there were fireflies in Vietnam and then first night on patrol running into a bush and the bush lit up like a Christmas tree and I was scared to death. I didn't know what it was. But nobody ever told me there were fireflies in Vietnam, so I thought we were dead. But there are a succession of those kinds of stories that I decided to put down on paper.
And how long did it take you to write the manuscript?
Right around 6 to 8 months.
But did you have to do a lot of research? I mean, a lot of these things were, experiences you had personally, but did you have to contact other of your sailors, former colleagues and so forth to get information, or was everything pretty much based on what you already knew?
Well, I'm fortunate in that I'm close to the Mid-Atlantic chapter of the Game Wardens of Vietnam, of which I'm a lifetime member, who have been very supportive in my telling of these stories. I'm fortunate also in that I've still remained in contact with a couple of the people that I served with over there, and they reinforced my view of what happened. Now, nowhere in that book do I claim this to be historically exact. Kind of accurate-ish as to the dates and so forth. But the rules that I imposed on myself was to try to tell the truth. But 35 or 40 years after the fact, it's kind of hard to be exact. I didn't want to put any gratuitous violence in the, or hate speech in the book. I didn't put any names in there whatsoever. I didn't name anybody that could be identified, except they know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
With tongue in cheek, of course.
So the
first reason I didn't want to have any war stories, as I've said before, those have already been told.
Sure.
Those really involve quite a bit of research, and fellows like Ralph Christopher that's preceded me in, with his writings on the war. Delves into the history with relish. I look at it and say, ooh, that's daunting. I think I'll just take the easy way out and write from my memory. Of course, don't ask me what I had for lunch yesterday, but...
did you happen to catch when I had Al Billings on as a guest?
Seawolf?
Did you happen to catch the show when I had Al Billings on as a guest?
On Friday.
Well,
I have never met the gentleman that I know of. I might have talked to him, or he might have filed a little support for me, but I don't believe I could pick him out in the crowd.
Yeah, he's. I've never met him in person either. We had a very fascinating show, and of course Ralph has been on, and Art Schmidt, another Vietnam vet, will be on in a few days. And I was in the service at the time. I was in Naval Air Corps. I was in 62 to 66, so I was in when things were really starting to heat up. But I was in a training command. We were training A-4 pilots at the time, so I never got over to Vietnam. I wasn't in a combat zone. So talking to you fellas, I'm learning a lot about what happened with my colleagues, even though I wasn't physically with them. Mentally I was, and emotionally. So it's actually been a great learning experience for me to talk to some of the combat people and, you know, and hear their experiences and some of the events that happened. And it's really quite enlightening.
Well, coincidentally, one of the A-4 pilots that you might have trained, Joe Shadell, ended up his tour in the Navy as air boss on USS Kennedy, did the illustrations for me. Yeah, he was an A-4 pilot. And,
oh, really?
He and I were on Enterprise at the same time. The only difference was I was down in the engineering spaces, and he was flying off the roof. So.
And he did the illustrations, huh?
Yes, he did.
Now, when was your book actually published? When was it out of the printers and actually available for sale?
August of last year.
August of last year. Mm-hmm. And... Well, let me back up a little bit and talk about writing for a minute. When you finished the manuscript, what route did you take to find a publisher, or what publishing option did you go?
Well, I found a couple of places that were, as you discussed Friday with the gent that was on, there are some places that will take your money and run without providing any sort of service. It's like if I pay somebody to edit my manuscript, they might feel obliged to find something wrong with it. I did run it by some people that I knew that were that had a strong history in editing work, and they didn't quite get the story I was trying to tell. They wanted to put it back inside the normal framework of a novel, and that's not the direction I wanted to go. So I edited it myself with a little bit of help from a couple of friends. And I had the homonyms and making sure it was in the proper tense. It was a lot of fun.
Was it a lengthy process, or were you able to get through it fairly quickly?
The
editing phase.
Well, I edited it each paragraph, sentence, phrase, and so forth as I went, but compiling it and then looking at the entire manuscript in one piece and reading through it, it was a continuous effort over the 8 or 9 months that it took me to write the thing.
Okay, so you edited today as you went.
Yes.
And now, I just got a text message. I think this is a tongue-in-cheeker from Karen. And she said, ask Bill if he contacted John Kerry for assistance. LOL. So John Kerry did not contribute to your book?
No, I don't know what he contributed to.
Okay. Okay. Now, other vets who are familiar with your book, your feedback from them, you say, has been pretty positive so far, and nobody's objecting to you taking a look at the humorous side of war?
The only person that has ever taken a distant view of humor in war was a person I ran into several months ago who said nothing funny ever happens in a war. And I said, first of all, I prefaced it by saying that there's nothing funny about war at all. I mean, people die and get injured seriously. But I said, if you haven't been there, you can't tell me that there aren't funny things that happen. Then I asked her if she had read the book. She said, no. And I said, well, okay, read the book, then get back to me. I haven't heard from her since.
Which is a good sign. Yeah. Now, when you were obviously you saw some, you know, like you said, war is a serious business, and then you obviously saw quite a bit of combat. Do you ever get asked today, and maybe I should say over the past few years since we've been involved in Iraq, I know there were some points that people were making a comparison of Iraq to Vietnam, and you know, the word quagmire and so on and so forth. Have you had any inquiries or people asking you for if you felt that the Vietnam War was had any similarities to the situation in Iraq?
Well, the similarity that I see is that in the 60s we had the domino effect in that if we didn't take care of the Red Menace over in the Southeast Asia, pretty soon they'd be marching down Main Street. Well, you fast forward to this year and you listen to talking about fighting Al-Qaeda. If we don't fight them over there, they're going to be marching down Main Street. Well, I believe in a strong defense, and a part of a good defense is a strong offense as well. But I believe strongly that some of the mainstream media doesn't want to report some of the things that go on in country. And for whatever reason, I just feel or believe that there are some in the media that their desire to win a prize for capturing a story is worth more than the effort that the country is trying to put forward to bring freedom to those folks over there in Iraq. Period.
Yeah, it's the power of the media is actually amazing and sometimes scares me a bit of how news can be directed or tailored. I don't want to branch off into a political debate because we're going to do that in a future program. But
don't get me wrong. I enjoyed jerking them around when we had the opportunity. There a couple of times in Vietnam where they tried to pass themselves off as something that they weren't. They wouldn't tell us that they were correspondents. They had some cockamamie story about visiting fellows and so forth, but we would find out who they were, and then we'd feed them information.
Mm-hmm.
We fed them information that was so bogus that to anybody that was looking at it, they'd say, these people can't be real. So we had our game. We played games with them.
Good. Good. Now, would you want to give us, you mentioned the fireflies in Vietnam and that you weren't aware of them and it scared you the first time you saw this burning bush.
I tried to be cool about it.
Would you want to give us a few other examples of some of the things that are in the book or some of the things that you found humorous?
Well, If I were to say it right now, no, I can't think of anything. We might as well just hang up, huh?
It'll be a long next 30 minutes if you can't think of anything.
Yeah. Let me see. There's one of my favorites towards the back of the book when we talk about creeping down a river.
Not creeping. Come on my ride.
We got a caller on the line here, Bill.
Who might that be?
Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Greetings.
Greetings to you. How? I got my hand up. How?
How? How are you doing? What can we do for you?
Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to get some stuff done. You know, I like a book done, you know, I like that. But you know what? My writing is kind of like to be desired.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how to spell very well. And, you know, punctuation is like obsolete. And run-on sentence is pretty much the way I do it. And, you know, I'm just looking for somebody that would love to, you know, go over my stuff with me, you know. You can take it if you want and run with it. Send it out to a friend. I really don't care.
Okay.
Just as long as you can make it sound good and clean it up so it's acceptable to
so-and-sos
that are, like, so particular.
Let me suggest this. I don't want to take the time away from my guest here this morning.
I'd like to write my book the way my book, and, you know, see if you guys can handle it.
Okay, well, why don't you send me an email, griff1945@hotmail.com.
I don't know how to email, and then by the time I get to my email, I don't know, I'm already frustrated, then I want to, like,
thanks for calling. I'm going to have to let you go because I want to get back to my guest. We only have a limited amount of time.
We have, like, internet
for the call, ma'am.
How to...
Bill.
Yes, sir, I'm still here.
Are you still with me? Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that was about, so I didn't mean to disrupt you. Go ahead. You were just going to tell us something if it was in the back of the book that you thought was humorous.
Well, I can tell you a story about the Seawolf pilots.
Okay.
We were in a place called Ben Luck, where we shared a community in a little tent village, sort of like scene out of the Grapes of Wrath. But we lived in a tent city, and our closest neighbors were Seawolf pilots. They were constantly on the go, flying close air support for us. We gave them a lot of slack because they're our lifesavers. Early one morning, I was in my tent trying to sleep off the effects of a night patrol, and I heard his truck come right by close to my head. Well, it turns out, I'm just going to paraphrase the whole thing here.
Sure.
I went outside and found that these Seawolf pilots had a refrigerator on the back of a truck, and they were going to put it into their little hooch, the little hut we called a hooch. And I thought it was difficult getting a fan for our tent, but these guys took the prize. But they had a refrigerator, and it was already loaded with beer. It was cold at like 6:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So we got the thing off the truck and into their tent. And we said, well, gee, we might as well have breakfast. You know, PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon, was a breakfast of champions over there. So we snorkeled through a few cans of beer, and pretty soon there's a puddle at our feet from the condensation from the refrigerator. So it was growing larger and larger and larger, and I said, we discussed it. So I said to the ONC, I said, give me a 45, would you? A 45 pistol. And I aimed it, put a round through the middle of the puddle, and it just sort of drained out. When the MPs came in, they want to know why I used a 45 to put a hole in the floor. And I said, because an M16 is too small, a 12-gauge shotgun is too big, and a 45 was just right. They left shaking their head. So that's just one little story. And some people might think that's, you know, a waste of tax dollars of people having fun in a situation like that. Well, okay, we had to take our entertainment where we could find it.
Absolutely. It's just to make, I don't know if this is a good comparison, but I was in police work for quite a while, and they have what they call, refer to as police humor sometimes, or dark humor, where cops can find humor in situations that other people wouldn't necessarily find funny. And I think in a way it's similar to your situation. I mean, you were in serious times and serious situations, yet there was humor to be had. And if you don't, I know some of the guys, going back to police work, if you... if you don't have some relief, you know, you can end up with emotional problems and bad. So you have to find, as you say, the humor where you find it. I mean, that's where it is, and you have to accept that, and that's part of life in those situations.
Well, I agree totally. That if you don't vent somehow, it's going to bottle up and explode someday, maybe inappropriately.
And that's a lot of times the types of stories you read about, right? You know, in the news and so forth, about somebody snapping, and that lack of venting is probably, I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but I suspect that lack of venting is contributes in some cases to those incidents.
Well, I have another story to tell you about humor while we were in action.
Mm-hmm.
We were going up a river one night. It was very dark. It was up close to a place called Tay Nin, right up on the Cambodian border. It was July of 1969, and in order for me, we didn't have any fancy communications gear between a crew. It was we would whisper if we were in ambush, waterborne guard post, and if there was something going on when the shooting was going on, we'd have to yell to make ourselves heard. Well, one night we were steaming up the river, and I was on the cover boat, the boat that trailed behind the lead boat, and we took some fire from up on the banking, and so we, in a free fire zone, we didn't have to wait. We just let go with what we had, and you know. Stop and think of it. For some guy to stand up with an AK-47 shooting 7.62, facing down six 50 cal machine guns and at least two or three M-60s, he's either A, brave beyond belief, stupid, or has a big death wish. Because it's going to fly. Anyway, we've suppressed the fire rapidly, and I took a deep breath because the twin 50s were right in front of me, and I had to yell to make the gunner hear me so he would cease fire. So I inhaled deeply. And when I did to inhale deeply to get some breath so I could yell to my gunner, this bug flew down my throat and hit my barf button on the way by, and I was immediately sick beyond belief and lurched out of the coxswain's flat, and I was heaving over the side. My engine man thought that I had been hit, and by the time I made him realize that I was okay, it was just a collision between the nature and myself. He had called for a medevac helicopter and getting ready to have another boat captain come on board, and I think they were ready to cut up my personal effects too. I'm not quite sure. Well, I thought that was over. I was over it for a while, and we got back to the base after the patrol was over, and everybody that wasn't on patrol was on the pier waiting for us to come in. This one character had a frog on a string. And he said, "We have a way. If you get that BC bug, all you got to do is eat this frog." Now, I'd been to survival school, but it didn't prepare me for that. There were some people that had bets going as to whether I would or whether I wouldn't eat that little frog. I chose not to, so somebody lost some money.
So
they say in the book we had serious entertainment deprivation issues at Ben Luck, or Ben K.O., excuse me.
Bill, let me ask you this, to return a minute to the writing business. Once the book was published last year, how did you have a marketing plan, or what were your goals? Did you want to sell a million copies, make a lot of money? Did you just basically want to get the stories out there, or some combination? And did you have a sales goal, or how you would measure the success of the book?
Well, I think like any writer that is serious about what they're trying to do, they dream of the big movie deal or the big prize at the end of the year. I looked at it and I said, this is good for me. My wife tells me, although I don't remember things, that I sometimes have outbursts in my sleep and about my period of time in Vietnam. Those have since dissipated immensely. So for me, it was therapeutic, and the payoff was getting it in print and out to the people, and in acceptance of the stories told and the manner in which I told them was important, because you talk to any group of Vietnam vets, and we feel, I can't speak for the whole crew, but I feel as though we were maligned for many, many, many years. And I feel as though while other books are accurate to the facts, mine is a little different in that it does bring up the humor, and it doesn't bring us down, if you follow what I mean.
I follow what you mean.
My reward was in doing it itself. That was the reward. Now, I must confess that I have visions of wheeling books out to the mailbox and wheeling bales of money in.
Right. You share that vision with a lot of us, I'll tell you that. Bill, hold on just a second. We got another caller. Let me answer him here.
Sure.
Hi, caller.
Yeah, hey, this is Rick Woolard. I was in Vietnam as a SEAL Team 2 platoon commander with Bill Ferguson back in 1969, in a place called Song and Dock. And I'm sorry I haven't called in sooner. I'm on the road right now, traveling up the eastern shore of Virginia, and I haven't been able to listen because the reception here is spotty, so I pulled over. But, Bill, I had a question for you here. Now, you were there in Song and Dock at that Advanced Tactical Support Base, the same one that we were at, and your boats were taking my steel platoon out and inserting us and extracting us in the course of our missions. And we were relieved in May of 1970 by another SEAL Team 2 platoon. And I know you probably worked with them for at least part of the time, although they did relocate to a different place partway through their tour. But my question for you is, did they like to water ski on the Song and Dock River behind PBRs that you piloted as much as my platoon did?
Thanks for the call, Rick. I recall riding a slick down from Binh Tui. I had a case of booze on the airplane, and these one or two guys from the platoon had a single water ski. And I said to them, "How come you got one water ski?" And they said, "Well, they had two, and they don't need two. All they need is one." So they purloined it from Na Bay, and it was a lot of fun riding past that village. We used the tow rope that was on the back of the boats with a grappling hook at the end of it for pulling boats off that had been beached. And while it was pretty much the norm for the villagers to see a PBR go by at speed, they weren't quite used to seeing the upper half of a person going by waving at them. Well, the village was elevated up on stilts, and they couldn't see down to the water, and it was quite humorous. A lot of fun with that.
Yeah, that would have been Bill Beebe and Larry Rich, the two water skiers there, and I know they did it, and I didn't want them to do it, but at least I think they probably had the common sense to vary the time of day at which they did it, so they wouldn't present a repeating target for any nasties who might have been around.
Well, it was a free fire zone right across from the village, so at any time somebody could have unloaded back from that direction. So part of Song on Dock where I was at down there is going to be in the next book.
Bill, were you there when they? I understand that sometime after my platoon left, the barges that we were on came under attack and basically were pretty much, if not completely destroyed, at least damaged heavily. Were you there when that happened?
No, I got out just prior to that happening. It was quite devastating, I understand. I don't have the facts on it. All I know is it was pummeled quite severely by the enemy, and they had to evacuate and get upriver. So not a pretty time.
Well, Bill, all I can say is I read the first book with great interest and pleasure, and I recall having worked with you all those years ago, and the sense of humor that you had back then is the same way that came out in the book, and I wish you all the best with the new book coming out about Song and Dock.
Thank you, Rick, and maybe someday you'll tell us where you hid those cigars. We could always tell when the op was over when the cigar came out.
Those are special Italian cigars that that my wife would send me. That they were very hard to find, but the great thing about them was that they were pretty much impervious to water or anything else. So that even if they were wet at the end of an operation, I could still pull out a Perotti and fire that thing up. And yeah, that was the equivalent of Miller time back then.
A little dab of C4 in the end would help too, wouldn't it?
Rick,
thanks for the call, Rick.
Rick.
Yes.
Rick. Yeah, Denny Griffin, thanks for calling. And before I let you go, I just want to tell you we got a text hello to you from Karen, and she said, "Hi, Rick, from the good guys."
Ah, okay, great.
So,
well, that's wonderful. I'm going to have to get on my road, get on the way up the road here, but it was great to be able to participate. And, Bill, all I can say is I really enjoyed that first book and looking forward to the next one.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Right, Daddy. Bye now. Bill, it reminds me, would you have a second to give out any contact information for you if someone has questions for you or wants more information about you or your book or where they can buy the book, if you have a website or email or anything you'd like to share?
Well, I have an email address. I think everybody has one of those now.
It's, go ahead.
This is all one word, the Bill Ferguson, THEBILLFERGUSON, at earthlink.net.
The Bill Ferguson at earthlink.net.
Now, the story there is when I came down to where I'm living now from Virginia Beach, I tried to get just Bill Ferguson. And we went through Bill Ferguson 1 through about 150, and I said, well, wait a minute, there's only one Bill Ferguson.
the Bill Ferguson. Good.
No legal problem here. The book's available several places. It's available on the Task Force 116 website, Task Force 116 being the title of Operation Game Wardens, the operation that the overarching operation for PBRs in Vietnam. And you can get it through Barnes & Noble. All the big box stores have it.
Let me ask you just in the event and the listeners aren't familiar with the terminology, PBR is Navy jargon for patrol boat river. Would that be accurate?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. What we were on were 31-foot-long the boat I was on came out of a place called Uniflight Boat Works up in Bellingham, Washington. Excellent boat, very good boat, very sturdy, and it was glommed together by the folks at Uniflight and Navy people in about just a couple of months. And they started. It was built on the original hull, and we had twin 50s up forward, M60 machine guns, midships, which were 7.62, they're still in service, in 50 aft. Sometimes we had a mortar we put in there and so forth, and assorted in various and sundry items. Essentially, sailors like to play with guns and make things blow up, so we carried a lot of stuff that would break other things. We operated in pairs mostly. Sometimes there would be more than two boats. Never in my experience would you see a boat, one boat, single boat patrol out there by themselves. It's a risky business because there's nobody there to help you out in case you get in trouble. Our job was to patrol the rivers of South Vietnam to keep supplies from filtering across the border or crossing the rivers. If you look at a map of Vietnam, you don't see Route 95, 85, 75, so forth going north in the 66 going west, you see a bunch of rivers and tributaries and canals, man-made canals and ditches, and that's the main mode of transportation in the Delta. At least it was when I was there. And the enemy was very good at moving supplies. Our job was to stop them. The way we did that was we would patrol. We had patrols on the river, 12 on and 12 off, generally. We would pick and choose who we were going to search. We'd vary our tactics from day to day because the worst thing you could possibly do would be set a pattern in a guerrilla warfare. Do it once, okay, fine. Do it twice, ooh, you're treading on thin ice. Do it the third time, you're dead. So we varied the way we did our business. And we were quite successful, and I won't claim that we eliminated the flow of arms and war materials and so forth, but we sure put a crimp in their style. It was, when I joined up for river patrol boats, I was thinking about, you know, a river, like a big, wide river.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes with these canals, we went down in the place like the Rungsat Special Zone, which is called the Forest of the Assassins. We might have palm fronds slapping up against the side of the boat where we were zipping down through there at night at about 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Very exciting stuff.
Now, how fast was 30 miles an hour the max for these boats, or would they go faster than that?
Give or take, depends upon how much ammo you had on board and the balance of the boat and how deep the water was. You can, if in a river patrol boat, they didn't have propellers. They had jacuzzi pumps. And suck the water through the bottom of the pump, blow it out the back of the boat. That provided our propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
It would run in about a foot of water, maybe a little bit less. When I say run in a foot of water, that's skimming along at high speed. And you were dancing on thin ice then, because if you decided to slow down, you wouldn't slow down easily. You'd come to an abrupt stop because if you're going that fast and the water's that shallow, you're going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
The boat weight, I forget how many tons, but it was a bunch of weight. It would come down, and everything that was on the boat, it wasn't tied down, would probably go with a bow. So we'd probably run between 25 and 30 knots.
And you may have said this, and I missed it, but what was the crew, how many crew members?
A normal crew would be a gunner, not necessarily a gunner's mate, but somebody that was expert in the weapons that we had on board. Generally, the heavy stuff was the 50 machine guns and the M60s and so forth, M16, standard military equipment. An engine man who was trained in maintaining the engineering plant. We had two Detroit diesel 6B53 diesels driving. It's funny how I remember this nomenclature. Two 14YJ jacuzzi pumps and associated pumps and belts and pulleys and filters and so forth. Then we had a seaman who I describe in a book sometimes as a gopher, you know, go for this, go for that.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of those people, and a boat captain, that would be me in some cases. And most of the time I was on the boats. Now, each boat had a crew of four, and when we went on patrol, to coordinate the efforts of that patrol in that particular area, we'd have a patrol officer. Usually a chief or a junior officer, chief petty officer E7-8-9, or a junior officer, lieutenant ensign, lieutenant JG, and so forth. Occasionally, an E6 or an E5 may be picked for patrol officer. That gets interesting, because as I said in my book, I was trained as an engineer for ships. Usually, my rating specialty was in steam turbines. On steam-driven ships, and I had branched out a little bit, and I had an oxygen, nitrogen generation enlisted code, which meant going back to an aircraft carrier. So I was amazed at how much power and authority that we had while operating those boats. It was like there's nothing I ever expected. I joined the Navy just because it was not guaranteed, but thought there'd be three squares and a flop every day and
yeah.
A nice warm bunk at night. Not true. The Navy can send you places you never dreamed of before. Well,
it was
our job, and we did it. And it was the letdown came was when we get back to the real Navy. And they didn't quite know how to behave with us around because we were all crazy. We were used to getting our own way, and we had some troubles adapting.
Whole different lifestyle, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, Bill, let me ask you this. Karen had mentioned earlier jokingly about John Kerry, but well, it was just about 4 years ago now. There was when Mr. Kerry was running for president, there was a lot of talk about Vietnam, his Vietnam experiences, and his allegations of some of the things that took place of you know, this, some of our military personnel running amok and doing all kinds of bad things. And certainly, I'm sure when you have that many troops involved in a war situation, there are going to be instances of things that probably would just as soon not have happened. But you were there, and you were in combat. Did you see the situation rampant of people out of control and murdering civilians and all that kind of thing?
I have seen instances of bullets that you wish you could take back.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw anybody maliciously or with a forethought blow somebody away just because they wanted to do that or in the heat of whatever to take retribution on an innocent. No, I never saw any of that. I never saw sailors do drugs other than beer.
And
stronger stuff. You can't deny that those things happen. I mean, two words, me lie.
Right, right.
That kind of stuff happens. And I never saw it, and to claim that we all did it was a false claim, in my opinion. And Mr. Kerry has to live with his words. And
so,
I'll live mine, which is, I've said enough.
would it be safe to say then that other than isolated incidents such as what you just mentioned, that overall we had some good personnel and who were doing the right thing? We didn't have just turn loose a bunch of murderers and rapists on the country.
No, I would say good was the bottom of the scale. Excellent was probably the norm, and far superior to normal sailors was the scale by which I judge people. Because sailors, ordinary plain deck plate sailors, take them off a ship, give them a few months of training, put them through some rather strenuous preparation work to get over there, put them in charge of a boat, or make them a gunner or an engineman on a boat. He's got responsibility. The engine is responsible for making sure that engine will run properly and respond when we need it. These young men performed admirably, and I have nothing but good words for them. However, there are those that didn't perform, and they are weeded out. You know, I saw some action. And other people saw more, and some people saw less. Everybody that I talked to has said, at one point or another, they feared how they would react when they were under fire for the first time. And that nags at you until it's over, and then it's over, and wow, that wasn't so bad, unless you get shot, and then it's bad.
Right.
But. That's another one of the things that I made myself promise that I wouldn't do, and that was to out anybody that had not performed up to their standards. I didn't want to spoil somebody's life. If Grandpa went off to Vietnam and he's been telling us stories about his exploits over there for the past 35 or 40 years, it's not going to be Bill Ferguson that tells his grandchildren that Grandpa's puffing the story a little bit. I wouldn't do that. I refuse to do it. I spent 2 weeks writing about a particular individual. I was going to out that sucker. And really, I had some serious issues with that guy. But I decided in the end run, in the long run rather, that the best remedy for that was, because I got to live inside of my skin, was to just let it go.
Right.
So.
Do you think, I don't say we lost the war, I guess it was considered a stalemate, but had it not been for the politics and the restrictions, some of the restrictions placed through the political leaders and the protests and all that kind of thing, do you think we'd have beat them?
We did beat
them. You've actually won.
We did beat them.
Well, that's my concern, but a lot of people say no. I don't agree with that. I think we won the war. I think the fact that it wasn't a clear-cut victory, perhaps, to some people, is that the political aspect of it kind of sabotaged us. But.
Yeah, it's, you know, of course, who is it that tells us that we're wrong to say that we lost? It's the news media, the mainstream, some of the mainstream guys. So we're back.
Yeah.
The people that were there, I saw my opinion of the war change after I go over there. I wasn't over there to kill Viet Cong. I was over there personally to save my butt. I mean, and those are my shipmates, those people that were around me. My job was to protect them, and their job was to protect me. And we did our job, but it wasn't for any sort of lofty strategic objective like pacifying the countryside. We were there to kill as many of them as before they could kill us.
Bill, I hate to cut you, but we've already exceeded our time limit, and we got cut off on the live stream. However, what we're talking about now will be in the archives, so anybody who replays the program will not miss anything. But I really appreciate you being on today, and it's been very, very informative and enjoyable talking with you. And we're going to continue with another look at Vietnam on the 8th, and my guest will be Art Schmidt. So it's going to be another 45-minute show, and we'll continue with the Vietnam theme. So I hope everybody can catch us. Bill, thanks again for being with me, and best of luck with your book and your upcoming book.
Well, thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Have a great one.
You
bye-bye.
Too.
Okay, again, I want to thank Bill Ferguson for being my guest today. And the book, authored by Bill, is Laughter and the Rivers of Death, One Sailor's Humorous Experiences in Vietnam. And I hope you can join me for the next program, and the next Vietnam-related program will be on the 8th with guest Art Schmidt. Thank you, and have a great day.